Morning, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. John Waters celebrated his 70th birthday in April. From his early days as an enfant terrible filmmaker and the King of Sleaze, he has sustained a remarkable career as an author, a stand-up comedian, a visual artist, and one of America's most thoughtful observers on the cultural landscape. He's the master of reinvention, and no work is more emblematic of that than Hairspray, which was a movie, a musical, and then a movie of a musical. This weekend, he'll narrate Hairspray in yet another iteration, a symphonic production with the BSO. John Waters joins me this morning to talk about art, politics, and how to keep looking ahead. Then WIPR's Lisa Morgan talks to Andrew Oak, who goes on the road with America's First Ladies. Jay Wynn Russick previews the Baltimore Playwrights Festival, and Tom Pelton puts the environment in focus. First, the news.
I'm producer Kathleen Cahill. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, and 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning.
Morning, everybody. On 81 WIPR, it's Maryland Morning. Glad you're with us. I'm Tom Hall. John Waters is the writer and director of 16 movies, the author of 6 books, a stand-up comedian, and a frequently exhibited visual artist. He made his first short film more than 50 years ago and quickly established himself as an enfant terrible. In April, he celebrated his 70th birthday, so on some level, perhaps he has morphed from enfant terrible to éminence grise. His most recent book is called Carsick, in which he chronicled an incident-rich hitchhiking trip across America. And one of his most popular creations is his 1988 movie Hairspray. And just as John Waters has reinvented himself as an artist in a host of platforms other than movie making, Hairspray has taken a foothold in American popular culture in several different forms. It was a movie, then a musical, then a movie of the musical, and this week it will make an encore appearance as a full symphonic production when John narrates Hairspray with the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, and John Waters joins me in the studio. Happy birthday. It's good to see you, man.
Thank you so much. The birthday that will never end right now. Now I can say I'm going on 71.
Yeah, there you
remember
go.
When you were younger, you wanted to be older?
I'm going on 12, and now you're going on 71. So your birthday was in April, the 70th birthday. It's a round number, a milestone. I mean,
I'm a filth elder.
Yeah, what are you, a filth elder. So what are your reflections? I mean, what do you think now?
Well, you know, I don't know that I feel any different. Physically, I do. I see pictures of myself and say, oh, my God, you're old. But at the same time, my last movie was NC-17. You know, things aren't that different in a way from what I'm doing. My stand-up show I've been doing for many, many years. And Hairspray being reinvented like this is the second time we've done it. We did it very successfully the first time. And I'm thrilled to come back. I want them all to do it. I want to get all of them out there. I want Hairspray on ice and then in space.
Hairspray in space. Well, that's perhaps, you know, as possible as Hairspray.
Anything's possible.
I mean, you are a real student of film history and filmmaking. Your early work, of course, had sort of cult status, the Pink Flamingos, you know, era. Hairspray was this huge commercial success, and it's, you know, some 30 years later. When you look at this movie now, the original idea, how does it strike you?
Well, you know, Hairspray, the movie I made was a modest success because Divine died a week after it came out, which puts a big damper on the box office of a comedy when you've been touring all over the country and they have pictures of you and Divine happily and then they cut to me carrying the coffin. That is not the best promotion. It did hurt it in a way. And then, of course, what was phenomenally successful was the Broadway musical. And the movie that they made out of it, the big musical with John Travolta, was a huge success. Now, of course, I've seen financial statements that claim it hasn't broken even.
But, that's because they owe you money.
That's kind of normal, right. And so it is amazing. It is the gift that keeps on giving. I have been paid what people don't know. 3 different times, once to write the sequel to the musical, once to write the sequel to Hairspray as a weekly TV series, and most recently to HBO for the big sequel movie event. None of them happened. They all went into turnaround very nicely. They paid me Hollywood money. It's wonderful. I'll write the next one. I know everything what happens to every one of those characters for the next 30 years, if anybody ever pays me or if it ever becomes real to see what happens.
Now, is NBC going to do this as a live
thing? Oh, NBC's doing it. Yeah, that's not me. That's certainly apparently I'm involved.
So that's not you. So
no, that's not me.
But what does that mean, that's not you? I mean,
well, it's not me. The day after the HBO deal fell through on me doing the sequel to Hairspray as an HBO movie event, this was announced. So Warner Brothers owns the rights to it, which used to be New Line. They're wonderful to me. I love working with Warner Brothers. I have no problem. Who would have ever thought Warner Brothers distributes Pink Flamingos? They do now.
Yeah.
So it happened, and I didn't know anything about it. I found out about it from Deadline Hollywood when I got the thing on my phone. My agent called me.
So
right,
when's that going to happen? When is that going to be?
That's a Christmas. Yeah.
Christmas of this year.
Yeah. They really didn't have to contact me for this. Each time with a musical, it gets a little further and further. It's like a Xerox. It gets each time. It gets a little bit further away. But at the same time, because of New Line, I have a deal with certainly different than the musical where they came to me and I was involved in everything. And they came to me eventually this time too. It's fine. I'm all for it. Are you kidding? I am all for it.
But one would assume you get paid something.
Oh, yeah, I get paid.
Yeah.
Oh, I get paid. Yeah. Yeah. But there's all different levels of how you get paid.
Right.
And so I'm thrilled. Especially this time, I don't have to do anything. But I'm hoping that if this is a success each time, then the sequel will come back. You know, so I am for every single thing that happens with Hairspray. I'm completely for it.
Of course, the subject matter of Hairspray, the racial inequality that you wrote about, you know, happening in this city in Baltimore in the 60s, those problems still exist today.
Of course they do. And you wonder if there was a teen dance show, which I think there should be again. Kids don't slow dance anymore, but could 14-year-old black and white kids slow dance on television today? I'm not so sure even today that that wouldn't make some people uncomfortable. To me, Hairspray is a Trojan horse that snuck in. Even racists love Hairspray. It's really strange to imagine, even though what it's saying is against what many people believe, those same people that don't believe in it still like Hairspray. So it's a Trojan horse. It's a sneak attack.
You know, a week or so ago, John McCain's son, Senator John McCain, his son, who's married to an African-American woman, had to tweet to the haters who were complaining about an ad for like Old Navy or something that had a mixed race couple.
Yes.
The black woman, the white man, and then the mixed race child.
Right. And I mean, it's just as confusing the other way around. I know when Hairspray was on Broadway, George Senior and Barbara Bush came to see it, and they were doing the twist with like drag queens out front. You think, oh God, you know, it's like you don't know quite what to say here, but I think Hairspray is for everybody, and so amazing to me to see it now. It's playing in every grade school, high school, everywhere, but it's different now. Skinny black girls play Tracy because political correctness, you cannot in the public schools cast by weight or race or anything, and I think it doesn't make any sense, but that's good too, and the kids don't even question it.
Right.
Maybe that's really good. The best one when we have a skinny black girl playing Tracy. Maybe every cast should be the opposites. And it's never mentioned. Because in Hairspray, the weird thing, Edna, Tracy's mother, is always played by a man. But Tracy doesn't think her mother's a man.
Right.
It's a secret
right.
that the audience knows.
Mom is
that
mom.
They share with me.
Yeah.
It's an inside
which you
joke
made up.
That we're all in on. The cast is not.
You endorsed DeRay McKesson for mayor when he ran in the Democratic primary. So now Senator Catherine Pugh is the Democratic nominee. She'll be running against Republican Alan Walden mm-hmm. and a Green Party candidate named Joshua Harris. Any advice? I mean, Senator Pugh's the putative favorite.
Yes, I'm going to vote for Pugh.
Yeah. So any advice for her about how to leave this morass of racial inequality that's still so persistent and pernicious?
Don't ask white men like me that live in a good neighborhood. That's why I voted for why you want to DeRay. Ask a younger person that's a little more radical, but he had very well thought out ideas.
He
wasn't
indeed
here long enough, but his program he put out was not ill-advised. It was pretty good. Maybe I don't agree with it all, but we can't just have the same thing again and again and again. It doesn't work. It doesn't change anything. You know, and riots build. They take a long time for that to bubble and boil over. And it's boiled over. Let's hope that's not going to happen again. And to be honest, I don't think it will. But at the same time, I think that we have to try something different. I don't know the answers. Don't come to...
So what that different thing would be, you don't necessarily... Aren't
no,
able to
I wish I knew the answer. Yeah. I don't. The answer is to get out of your own neighborhood, to switch neighborhoods once a year like jury duty and have to live in Penn North. And Penn North gets to live in Ruxton. And I think we go to bars and get your hair done there and send your kid to school there and see it. And that works, but there's no way. Same way, how do you cure racism? You let people travel. But what do? You say you're sentenced for a hate crime. You're going to Paris. It works, but you can't do that. If you never leave your neighborhood and you never talk to people that are different from you, you will remain stupid. And there are no smart racists. And that's why I think people today know that they can't say it out loud. The smart ones know they can't say it. They can only think it, and that's even scarier. And that's why Hairspray still works.
A lot of folks are saying that Donald Trump and his candidacy and the ascendancy of the Republican, of himself in the Republican Party, has in fact given people permission to say it now. I mean, people are saying stuff now that they really were afraid to say before because Mr. Trump has sort of made that okay.
Yeah, there's anger out there. Do those people run anything? That's what they're mad about.
That they don't run anything.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. I don't think he believes it, to be honest. And I think he's better than the other ones.
He's better than the other 16 yeah. that he beat?
Yeah.
Obviously.
Really? Yes. For the first time ever, I felt sorry for Jeb Bush. But I'm totally for Hillary. You know, I even said Cuba doesn't want to be socialist anymore even. But but at the same time—
And if Cuba doesn't want to go there, why should Senator Sanders—
I am sick of talking about the election. God knows you're going to have a choice.
Right.
They don't agree on one thing.
The choice probably couldn't be clearer.
The choice, it could, yeah. Nobody can say, well, I don't know, they're the same. They aren't the same. But I just, we have to hear about this till November. Who hasn't made up their mind?
You just curated an exhibition in San Francisco. It closed at the end of last month at the Frenkel Lab in San Francisco. The indie art scene, which you've been very involved in, as well as movie making and writing books and stuff. Have you seen that change and progress in dramatic ways? I mean, does the fact that we've got an election that is what it is in the context of what artists have been doing over the last 10, 20 years?
No, there is no indie art scene.
There is
no. There is, but no one takes notice of it, really. I mean, it doesn't affect the price of artwork today. The art world you're talking about, and I'll be honest, the art world that I'm in and I show, is definitely not independent. That's why Baltimore is such a great city. It's the only city left where you can be a bohemian. It's the only place you can come here. But even the bohemian artists here want to be in the real art world.
Yeah, and the real art world
is not independent at all anymore. It's the least independent it's ever been in the history of the world. The next group of artists are already decided who they are at Yale and are in the right schools. They know the dealers. They know the collectors. And I'm not saying that's wrong. I would think art for the people sometimes is really dreary and the art's terrible. So I like the elitism of the art world. I think it's funny. And I certainly make fun of it even in the shows I do. But at the same time, there's hardly an independent film scene anymore. I mean, it's about making movies for China.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Well, we will have you back again when your next project comes out. It's a book, from what I understand.
No, I think the next project is Multiple Maniacs is coming out again, restored completely, and now it looks like a bad John Cassavetes movie.
And who doesn't like a bad John Cassavetes movie every so often? All right, John Waters, always a pleasure, and happy birthday again. We'll see you soon.
Thank you.
John Waters, he'll narrate a full symphonic production of his iconic classic Hairspray with Jack Everly, the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, and a cast that includes Laura Marie Rondinella, Paul Vogt, George Wendt, and many others. They'll perform tomorrow night at the Strathmore Music Center in Bethesda and on Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday afternoon at the Meyerhoff here in Baltimore. We've got ticket information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more coming up. Stay with us.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We are at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Andrew Oak is known as the First Ladies' Man. His new book is called Unusual for Their Time, On the Road with America's First Ladies. WYPR's Lisa Morgan sat down with Andrew Oak last week.
Well, Andrew Oak, welcome to Maryland Morning.
Thank you very much.
So tell me how you first got involved with America's First Ladies.
Yeah, it's kind of, I fell backwards into a project for C-SPAN. I was one of the producers on First Ladies Influence and Image. I grew up around the Washington, D.C. area, so I'd always been politically minded, as people are in this area, but never focused on history or these women in particular. But when I did this project for C-SPAN, my job specifically was to go out in the field, travel to every house, library, museum, train station, cemetery, church, school, for every First Lady, Martha Washington through Michelle Obama. With C-SPAN's good name and an all-access pass, I had the country's most fantastic and historical collections right there at my fingertips and recorded it all to bring back for the live show. And I just basically fell in love with every one of these First Ladies and their stories. They're just remarkable.
It's funny because I think a lot of us, we hear First Ladies, and of course we think Michelle Obama now, or there's been some that come to mind, Martha Washington, Dolly Madison.
Of course.
But you found that all of these women and in fact, in the title of the book, unusual for their time, that many of these women, or all of these women, had something about them that made them fairly special. What was that like to find that out?
That's an excellent point. We all conjure an image when I say First Lady. Like you say, is it Michelle Obama? Is it Jacqueline Kennedy? Is it Nancy Reagan? Is it Martha Washington? Everyone knows that 5 or 10. But there's over 40 women that have served as First Lady or official hostess for a relative's administration. And during these travels, at some point in time, at some location, and it was different in almost every case, these women became real to me. They stepped out of the pages of history books. They came off the oil paintings.
There's something fun about going to a location where it's the most important thing to the person who might lead you into this historic house. And you get this extra access. As you mentioned, you're working for C-SPAN. People want to give you all access. What was that like for you to show up at a location that you knew nothing about and then spend the day kind of immersing yourself?
That's a great question, and no one's asked me that specifically yet, but that's exactly it. I was a one-man band for this aspect of the show. There was a whole team of producers that were doing everything to make the 90-minute show happen in D.C., and I was the one out in the field. So I would have a phone interview with someone that I'd never met before, never worked with before, pack up 7 bags of gear, and pinball all across the country. If you go to my website, firstladiesman.com, there's a journey page, and it's got a map, and it shows where I traveled. And at the end of this thing, the executive producer and I looked at the map on my website, and we were both like, that didn't really happen, did it? And it didn't happen by yourself. I mean, like, just to carry 7 bags alone is a job in itself. So I would get to this place, and I would be set up for a full day of work with someone that I'd never worked with before. But as you mentioned, they're working at their spot in many cases because that president is their guy, or that first lady is their gal. And they are so tuned into that person that they're going to tell you the story better than anyone else because they're there to preserve the image, the legacy of those individuals. So when you go to the Harding House in Marion, Ohio, I mean, the woman there, the director there is Sherry is her name. All these people, there's so many women running around in my head, it's crazy. But Sherry is the director there, and she will take you through and tell you the part of the Harding stories that no one else will tell you. And you can see these artifacts in a lot of these houses, that house specifically. It looks like these people just went out to the store. I mean, there's still jewelry and jewelry boxes where they left it, clothes hanging in closets. As we get older as a country, we know that the preservation of this history is more and more important, so the collections get more vast and the evidence of these people's lives is more evident. But I wanted to know not only about the White House years, but before the White House, they're all little girls. They're all young women. They're all girlfriends, wives, mothers, sometimes even grandmothers before they get into the White House. And there's so much stuff out there to learn about all these women at all these locations that when you do go to one of these off the map, sort of off to the side places, it's so incredible because it's all brand new.
On 88.1 WIPR, it's Marilyn Morning. I'm Lisa Morgan. My guest is Andrew Oak. His new book is Unusual for Their Time, On the Road with America's First Ladies. So you mentioned doing that kind of travel. Not all of us can take the time and have the time or being made to for our jobs go to all these places.
Right.
But we can go along with you in this book. And how did you decide the structure to put it together this way, like we are actually traveling with
you? Yeah. Oh, good. I'm glad you. Yes. Mission accomplished, because that was the idea. When I was doing the work, when I was doing the travel, the thing that people found so amazing about this project was not only the women and the stories, but the process. And I think in today's day and age of director's cuts and behind the scenes and YouTube, and so in the written form, I can give access to what I did for 1 year and 2 months, which was exactly that, travel all over the country in places that people wouldn't get to go. I felt also when these collections were opened up to me and I saw the rarities and the stuff that will just never be on display because by its own existence, it's destroying itself. Dresses, jewelry, paper, documents, everything, that I did have a great responsibility given this access. I needed to let other people know this and people that couldn't travel to these out-of-the-way places. So I structured the book very carefully that it would be sort of a fun travel log that by the end you're like, oh, wow, I learned a bunch of stuff, because that's exactly what happened to me.
On 88.1 WIPR, it's Marilyn Morning. I'm Lisa Morgan. My guest is Andrew Oak, also known as the First Ladies Man, and we're talking about his new book, Unusual for Their Time, On the Road with America's First Ladies. Now, Another interesting thing that I did not know that you seem to come to realize as you met all of these first ladies was that many of our presidents, who we think of as great men, their stature was raised by, they married up, as
they,
we say.
They did marry up.
That's sort of an interesting little fact about our founding fathers.
It really is. Right from the beginning, George Washington could not have done what he did to make America, America, without Martha Washington. If we look at the Revolutionary War and the winter encampments that Martha Washington, at great risk, and I mean, she had a target on her back. She's the wife of the man who's leading the revolution. She traveled days, weeks, months, miles to get to George Washington and his winter encampments because he says, it's written in letters that have been preserved, luckily, that he can't think straight without her. He needs her around. He needs this comfort. He needs this sounding board kind of thing. But George Washington is not Martha Washington's first husband. She married Daniel Parke Custis back in Williamsburg before she met George Washington, but he's much older, Custis is, and he's much wealthier. The marriage almost didn't happen. It's a long story that I won't get into. It's in the book, but just know that Martha Dandridge had to marry Daniel Parke Custis to be in the position to be a widow that George Washington would fall in love with to get married so America could start. If we wanted to play like the Back to the Future game and go and mess with things and tweak, if that doesn't happen, we're not sitting here. She has, when her first husband dies, Martha Washington is in charge of over 8,000 profitable tobacco acres in and around Williamsburg, real estate of a quarter to a third of the town of Williamsburg, which is a serious hub at the time. And she's got over four times the governor's salary in silver, in cash on hand at her home. She's young. She's very, very attractive. There are paintings that go back to see. She's a young 26-year-old, very attractive and uber wealthy for the times. So from there on up through amazing men. I mean, you look at like the story of Lou Hoover and Herbert Hoover, the way they started together is, I mean, he's an orphan. She's not from much money. They're both from Iowa, but they meet under strange circumstances at Stanford University, and they become one of the wealthiest couples in history and the first of only two presidential administrations not to take salary because they've got so much money. They're so successful, but they're very giving with it, very philanthropic. We just don't know a lot of this because the Depression comes in, but these are the things you find out about these people as human beings, not just our president and first lady.
Another thing that I found reading through this was that sometimes, okay, they're marrying up, and that sounds very practical indeed, but also that there was a lot of love. There was a lot of these relationships were based on love and mutual respect and admiration, and people had a good match and a good life together.
Again, we don't have to go very far. I mean, I mentioned George Washington couldn't be without Martha Washington, things like that. But when Abigail Adams dies, John Adams writes to a friend. I think this might even have been the letter to Thomas Jefferson. I'm almost positive it is. He writes, "If only I could lie down beside her and die myself." I mean, these were life partners all the way up through and to. I mean, you look at Barbara Bush and George H.W. Bush and Nancy Reagan and Ronald Reagan, Michelle Obama and Barack Obama. I mean, these are real partnerships. These are real love matches. And also in modern times, political powerhouses like a John Adams and Abigail Adams, or, you know, like a JFK and Jacqueline Kennedy, things like that, the people that really seem to be out on the campaign trail and working for each other. But the Reagan story is just one for the ages. It's borderline ridiculous. You read the letters and you look at it and it's just like, I mean, this isn't, you know, you kind of expect it back in the 1700s, people to be like, oh, if I could die without, you know, it's all very Shakespearean and very flowery and Victorian. But the Reagans would write letters to each other. They spent a lot of time apart as he was governor and president of the Screen Actors Guild and did a lot of traveling, and even as president. But I liken them sort of to a Paul and Linda McCartney, that like they just were inseparable. They were really finishing each other's sentences. When they were out to dinner, not with themselves, they wrote letters to each other as if they were there at the table. Oh, I had the such and such, and you wouldn't have liked it because it was too salty, but you would have loved the soup, and then we would have laughed at this guy in a funny hat across the bar. They're really just, it is very endearing and very humanizing.
It makes me like the presidents more to get to know the women that they were married to more.
Very good point. Well, you know, as a lot of people do, is that the ladies always poll better than the husbands anyway. They're
true.
Not in an elected position. They are the highest ranking unelected official potentially in the country. You take someone like Bess Truman, who comes in after Eleanor Roosevelt. Eleanor Roosevelt, the longest sitting first lady. FDR was elected to four terms, an unprecedented four terms, dies very early on in his fourth term as president. 12 years, the same president. And thus, 12 years, the same first lady. He wouldn't have been president if it wasn't for Eleanor Roosevelt. He had contracted polio. FDR's a mama's boy. Sarah Roosevelt, his mom, basically pulled him out of public life and was like, that's it. You're just going to be a rich guy that hangs out in big houses and has parties. And you've got polio and you've done your bit and the Roosevelts have done their bit. But if that's the case, then Eleanor's trapped in there with him. So she becomes his legs, literally and figuratively, and hires this political genius powerhouse, a guy from Bethesda, Maryland, to come up and really prop him up and get him back out there. And then we have the longest sitting president in history. But Eleanor Roosevelt and people like that, Bess Truman, these influences that they have over the husband, Bess Truman comes in after Eleanor Roosevelt, so visual, and she's a backseat. She steps out of the limelight. She doesn't like it. But she and Harry Truman have been together or have at least had their eyes on each other since kindergarten school in Independence, Missouri at a Presbyterian church, like sort of like a basement daycare kindergarten kind of thing. They get together, start dating as teenagers, and they never looked at another person since. I mean, there's speculation, probably accurate speculation, that she was in on decisions about the bomb in World War II. These women sleep in the same beds as their husband. Think about you with your significant other, anyone out there with a significant other. You share things, you bounce things off people, and it's been happening since day one. It should not be a surprise that these women are so influential.
And so unusual for their time.
Indeed.
Well, Andrew Oak, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. I really have enjoyed getting to know our first ladies better, and I look forward to the following volumes and getting to know them all a little better, too.
Wonderful.
Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me in.
WYPR's Lisa Morgan spoke with Andrew Oak. His book is called Unusual for Their Time, On the Road with America's First Ladies. We've got a link to more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. The Baltimore Playwrights Festival turns 35 years old this season. And to mark the anniversary, our theater critic, Jay Wynn Russick, sat down with two of the festival's leading lights. Here's their conversation.
The Baltimore Playwrights Festival is one of the older, new play festivals in the United States. It has produced more than 300 plays since it began in 1982, and more than 24 local theater companies have participated. In recent years, however, the Baltimore Playwrights Festival has begun to shrink. Only 3 plays were staged in each of the last 2 seasons. Now, as it prepares to launch its 35th anniversary season, the festival's newly expanded board promises that this will be a season with a difference, several differences. Here in the studio to talk about the Baltimore Playwrights Festival's history, where it's been, and where it's going, are Michael Stricker, the festival's new chair, and Kimberly Lynn, one of its vice chairs. Michael and Kimberly, welcome to Maryland Morning.
Thanks for having us here.
It's marvelous to be here.
Well, let's start by talking about the way the festival has done things traditionally. This is a festival devoted to nurturing new scripts by playwrights with a Maryland connection. Scripts are submitted. Some of them get staged readings. Some of those get full productions in the summer. I don't think that model has changed much in the last 30-plus years. So, Michael Stricker, tell me how and why that model is changing now.
Well, about a year and a half ago, I just gotten on the board also, was secretary then. The board was starting to look at the festival, seeing that there were fewer theaters that were being involved. The excitement that had been there in the past wasn't there as much, and realized that we needed to either continue as is, try to improve what was, or rethink the festival. So we looked back to our mission, and that was to nurture playwrights, and we had to figure out how to do that. That was a continuing thing. This past winter, we finally decided that we would open it up to, in addition to the full performances, there would be book-in-hand staged performances. And we're also looking to do workshops to help the playwrights improve their craft.
Well, and of course, speaking of book-in-hand stage readings, as you can tell from the name, the Baltimore Playwrights Festival, as you say, Michael, focuses on playwrights. Sometimes scripts are not ready for full production. So, Kimberly Lynn, what do you think a playwright can get from a workshop or a stage reading that might not be as evident in a full production? And maybe here it's a good idea to start by explaining exactly what a stage reading is and how the new crop of readings the festival is going to be offering will differ from the readings that the festival has been doing each fall through spring.
The Baltimore Playwrights Festival has been considering adding stages of development to their whole procedure for many years. And this summer, you know, necessity becomes a mother of invention. And there were a bunch of companies who could not afford, we're all volunteers, to stage a full stage production. And so it becomes actually a lot more interesting for them to have the opportunity for something smaller. But what we're trying to do and trying to ask the theaters to do is to put these little gaps in the readings, because then it becomes almost more like a workshop. As a playwright, I've had 7 plays of mine developed through the Baltimore Playwrights Festival, and it's fantastic. They gave me my card as a Dramatists Guild member. And
it was your first full production,
yeah,
if I remember right,
yeah,
done by the
Candle
Playwrights Festival, like
right,
in 1992.
Yeah. And at the end of opening night, John Bruce Johnson handed me a package that was my Dramatists Guild package.
The head of the Vagabonds.
Right,
then,
the head of Vagabonds, exactly, yeah, handed me my membership guild package. It was a beautiful moment, and it felt like the moment I became a playwright. When you're in a full production situation, any full production situation, as a playwright, there comes a certain point when you have to freeze your text and where the actors have to come off book when they are memorizing that text. And the freedom that you have with a stage reading is that they have book in hand. In other words, you can give them changes. For example, right now, I'm working on something at the University of Baltimore that's not attached to the festival, but it's a workshop kind of situation, a reading of a new work. And the playwright's going to give us changes on Friday for Saturday's rehearsal, and you can just substitute those pages. And so you have that opportunity to develop the work as you hear it. And because we've been developing this kind of hybrid at the University of Baltimore at Spotlight UP for a bunch of years, and you can have any kind of range between music stands and chairs and pretty standard and, you know, just stage reading. Or you can actually add some blocking or some lighting or some costumes or some sound. It depends what the piece needs.
You're listening to Maryland Morning. I'm Jay Wynn Russick, and we're talking with Michael Stricker, chair of the Baltimore Playwrights Festival, and Kimberly Lynn, one of the festival's vice chairs. So you've talked about what the advantage can be for the playwrights. Michael, I wondered if you'd say something about what this developmental process, what attending a stage reading has as its appeal for an audience?
Well, it's never been seen before, so it's something brand new. It's something somebody local has written and spent their time with, and it's a work in progress. The person, you know, we have readers that read all the scripts that come in. We limit them to 85 new scripts a year. The readers look through it. Some are picked out for live readings over the winter time. And then after that, theaters get to pick the ones that they want to have on. And, you know, I've read things as they've come in. I've gone to a reading, and it's changed. By that point, it's improved from the audience reaction. And then, you know, it goes to a production, and it's improved even more. So you can see it all along the way.
So the audience is really kind of a participant. And part of, besides being able to be the first to see this, they are part of that developmental process in a way.
Oh, sure. Because
absolutely,
when you're writing, you're by yourself in that room, and you may say things out loud, and maybe it sounds good, but so many playwrights at the readings we've had over the winter have said, wow, I didn't know that that line could mean that thing. And it really, an audience reaction, they could see what really reached people and what maybe could have been cut. So
I think the American audience wants to be more engaged in the creative process, and that they love that, and they love that kind of contribution. And we have readers who come back to the winter readings. I mean, like readers who read all, you know, did all the vetting in the fall of the new work, and then they come
and they
want
to see how it's changed.
And they want to meet the playwright,
exactly.
Sure. So there's that kind of connection.
Well, this season's first offering is a stage reading of a play called The Room Where I Was Held by David Zaks. And it is being produced by two theaters, both of which are new to the Baltimore Playwrights Festival, Rapid Lemon Productions and Spotlight UB at the University of Baltimore. This is a play that will have two stage readings. The first is on June 11th, and then we have that broad gap you were talking about, Kimberly. The second reading isn't until June 24th. Tell us a little bit about what The Room Where I Was Held is about.
It's a story of post-traumatic stress disorder that a journalist is suffering because he's returned from being held captive by the Taliban, and he's in his parents' living room. And I don't want to, you know, give away too much, but basically there is that parallel between the prison where he was held, and now his parents' living room becomes, the, you know, a very similar kind of prison. And he has these flashbacks, unfortunately, to the trauma. And it's a great exploration of veterans returning to America and a consideration of those themes.
So a very urgent theme in that
place,
certainly.
And very much so, yeah.
We've been talking with Michael Stricker, Baltimore Playwrights Festival Chair, and Kimberly Lynn, a Vice Chair with the festival. Michael, Kimberly, thank you for joining us on Maryland Morning.
Thank you for having us.
You can find links to the Baltimore Playwrights Festival's website and schedule by going to our website, wypr.org, and clicking on the Maryland Morning link. I'm Jaywin Russick.
Jaywin Russick reviews the theater scene every week for Maryland Morning. That does it for us today. Coming up Friday, my conversation with Jacob Rue, whose investigations into systematic racial bias in Baltimore mortgage lending earned him this year's prestigious John Hope Franklin Award. Our movie mavens Anne Hornaday and Jed Dietz are here with tips on films worth watching this weekend, and the Baltimore Symphony's principal trumpeter Andy Balio on the future of classical music. Till then, thanks for joining us. Garrison Keillor's up next with the Writer's Almanac. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.